Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood.
Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.
What I found in my pocket.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Michael Robinson. What I Found in My Pocket by G.K. Chesterton.
Once, when I was very young, I met one of those men who have made the empire what it is. A man in an astrakhan coat with an astrakhan mustache, a tight, black, curly mustache. Whether he put on the mustache with the coat, or whether his Napoleonic will enabled him not only to grow a mustache in the usual place, but also to grow little mustaches all over his clothes, I do not know. I only remember that he said to me the following words: "A man can't get on nowadays by hanging about with his hands in his pockets." I made the reply with quite obvious flippancy that perhaps a man got on by having his hands in other people's pockets. Whereupon he began to argue about moral evolution, so I suppose what I said had some truth in it. But the incident now comes back to me and connects itself with another incident, if you can call it an incident, which happened to me only the other day. I have only once in my life picked a pocket, and then, perhaps through some absent-mindedness, I picked my own. My act can really with some reason be so described. For in taking things out of my own pocket, I had at least one of the more tense and quivering emotions of the thief. I had a complete ignorance and a profound curiosity as to what I should find there. Perhaps it would be the exaggeration of eulogy to call me a tidy person, but I can always pretty satisfactorily account for all my possessions. I can always tell where they are and what I have done with them, so long as I keep them out of my pockets. If once anything slips into those unknown abysses, I wave it a sad Virgilian farewell. I suppose the things that I have dropped into my pockets are still there. The same presumption applies to the things that I have dropped into the sea. But I regard the riches stored in both these bottomless chasms with the same reverent ignorance. They tell us that on the last day, the sea will give up its dead. And I suppose that on the same occasion, long strings of extraordinary things will come running out of my pockets. But I have quite forgotten what any of them are. And there is really nothing, except the money, that I shall be at all surprised at finding among them. Such, at least, has hitherto been my state of innocence. I here only wish briefly to recall the special, extraordinary, and hitherto unprecedented circumstances which led me, in cold blood, and being of sound mind, to turn out my pockets. I was locked up in a third-class carriage for a rather long journey. The time was towards evening, but it might have been anything, for everything resembling earth or sky or light or shade was painted out as if with a great wet brush by an unshifting sheet of quite colorless rain. I had no books or newspapers. I had not even a pencil and a scrap of paper with which to write a religious epic. There were no advertisements on the walls of the carriage. Otherwise, I could have plunged into the study, for any collection of printed words is quite enough to suggest infinite complexities of mental ingenuity. When I find myself opposite the words, "sunlight soap," I can exhaust all the aspects of sun worship, Apollo, and summer poetry before I go on to the less congenial subject of soap. But there was no printed word or picture anywhere. There was nothing but blank wood inside the carriage and blank wet without. Now, I deny most energetically that anything is or can be uninteresting. So I stared at the joints of the walls and seats, and began thinking hard on the fascinating subject of wood. Just as I had begun to realize why, perhaps, it was that Christ was a carpenter rather than a bricklayer or a baker, or anything else, I suddenly started upright and remembered my pockets. I was carrying about with me an unknown treasury. I had a British Museum and a South Kensington collection of unknown curios hung all over me in different places. I began to take the things out. The first thing I came upon consisted of piles and heaps of Battersea tram tickets. There were enough to equip a paper chase. They shook down in showers like confetti. Primarily, of course, they touched my patriotic emotions and brought tears to my eyes. Also, they provided me with the printed matter I required, for I found on the back of them some short but striking little scientific essays about some kind of pill. Comparatively speaking, in my then destitution, those tickets might be regarded as a small but well-chosen scientific library. Should my railway journey continue, which seemed likely at the time, for a few months longer, I could imagine myself throwing myself into the controversial aspects of the pill, composing replies and rejoinders, pro and con, upon the data furnished to me. But after all, it was the symbolic quality of the tickets that moved me most, for, as certainly as the cross of St. James means English patriotism, those scraps of paper meant all that municipal patriotism which is now, perhaps, the greatest hope of England. The next thing that I took out was a pocket knife. A pocket knife, I need hardly say, would require a thick book of full moral meditations all to itself. A knife typifies one of the most primary of those practical origins upon which, as upon low, thick pillows all our human civilization reposes. Metals, the mystery of the thing called iron and of the thing called steel, led me off half-dazed into a kind of dream. I saw into the entrails of dim, damp wood, where the first man among all the common stones found the strange stone. I saw a vague and violent battle in which stone axes broke and stone knives were splintered against something shining and new in the hand of one desperate man. I heard all the hammers on all the anvils of the earth. I saw all the swords of feudal and all the wheels of industrial war. For the knife is only a short sword, and the pocket knife is a secret sword. I opened it and looked at that brilliant and terrible tongue which we call a blade, and I thought that perhaps it was the symbol of the oldest of the needs of man. The next moment I knew that I was wrong, for the thing that came next out of my pocket was a box of matches. When I saw fire, which is stronger even than steel, the old, fierce, female thing we all love, but dare not touch. The next thing I found was a piece of chalk, and I saw in it all the art and all the frescoes of the world. The next was a coin of very modest value, and I saw in it not only the image and superscription of our own Caesar, but all government and order since the world began. But I have not space to say what were the items in the long and splendid procession of poetical symbols that came pouring out. I cannot tell you all the things that were in my pocket. I can tell you one thing, however, that I could not find in my pocket. I allude to my railway ticket.
End of What I Found in My Pocket by G.K. Chesterton.
To Francis. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Garth Donald. To Francis by G.K. Chesterton.
An excerpt from a letter to his fiancée, Francis.
When we set up a house, darling, honeysuckle porch, eucalypt hedge, bees, poetry, and 8 shillings a week, I think that you will have to do the shopping, particularly at Felixstowe. There was a great and glorious man who said, "Give us the luxuries of life, and we will dispense with the necessities." That, I think, would be a splendid motto to write, in letters of brown gold, over the porch of our hypothetical home. There will be a sofa for you, for example, but no chairs, for I prefer the floor. There will be a select store of chocolate creams to make you do the carp with, and the rest will be bread and water. We will each retain a suit of evening dress for great occasions, and at other times clothe ourselves in the skins of wild beasts. How pretty you would look! Which would fit your taste in furs, and be economical. I have sometimes thought it would be very fine to take an ordinary house, a very poor, commonplace house in West Kensington, say, and make it symbolic. Not artistic, heaven, oh, heaven forbid. My blood boils when I think of the affronts put on by knock-kneed pictorial epicures on the strong, honest, ugly, patient shapes of necessary things, the brave old bones of life. There are ascetic pattering prigs who can look on a saucepan without one tear of joy or sadness, mongrel decadents that can see no dignity in the honorable scars of a kettle. So they concentrate all their house decorations on colored windows that no one looks out of, vases of lilies that everyone wishes out of the way. No. My idea, which is much cheaper, is to make a house really allegoric, really explain its own essential meaning. Mystical or ancient sayings should be inscribed on every object. The more prosaic the object, the better. And the more coarsely and rudely the inscription was traced, the better. Hast thou sent the rain upon the earth? Should be inscribed on the umbrella stand. Perhaps on the umbrella. Even the hairs on your head are all numbered. Would give a tremendous significance to one's hairbrushes. The words about living water would reveal the music and sanctity of the sink. While our God is a consuming fire might be written over the kitchen grate to assist with the mystical musings of the cook. Shall we ever try that experiment, dearest? Perhaps not, for no words would be golden enough for the tools you had to touch. Your beauty would be enough for one house.
End of To Francis by G.K. Chesterton.
A Fairy Tale. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Chip Grogan. A Fairy Tale by G.K. Chesterton.
In novels, romances, scientific reports, and similar documents, we have all come across the story of the man who, on waking up, forgets his name and wanders out into the streets without an identity. He can exercise an ordinary intelligence, he can perform all ordinary functions, but he cannot remember who he is. I am in this position, but then, as it is a comfort to me to reflect, so are you. Every human being has forgotten who he is and where he came from. We are all blasted with one great obliteration of memory. We none of us saw ourselves born, and, if we had, it would not have cleared up the mystery. Parents are a delight, but they are not an explanation. The one thing that no man, however adventurous, can get behind is his own existence. The one thing that no man, however learned, can ever know is his own name. It is easier to comprehend the cosmos than to comprehend the ego. It is easier even to know where you are than to know who you are. We have forgotten our own meaning, and we are all wandering about the streets without keepers. All that we call common sense and practicality and worldly wisdom only means that we forgot that we have forgotten. All that we mean by religion and poetry only means that for one wild moment we remember that we forgot. I was sitting the other day on a heap of stones in the Isle of Thanet when I had remembered that I had forgotten. Not a straw had stirred, not a bird had spoken, but my blood ran cold, and I knew at once that I was in fairyland. The commonplace country landscape of Thanet lent itself more to the fairy notion than any imaginable mountains or lakes or caves. It is always easier to see this elvish look in plain and familiar objects because of a fact that men in our day mostly fail to understand, because it is exactly the homeliest part of man that is nearest to heaven and hell. We can think of a stool or a pot being bewitched. We cannot easily think of a cartoon by Raphael being bewitched. Neither can we easily think of the Alps being bewitched. It would require a witch of some force of character. But a domestic and even prosaic landscape, like that of this fiat corner of Kent, can be soaked in a supernaturalism all the more awful from being detached and alien from the landscape itself. Everything that stood up around me stood up as shapeless, and yet with some horrible hint of the human shape. Everything looked as if it had a face somewhere, but a face that was hidden or turned away. I seemed to be looking at the ugly back of everything. The stunted hedge looked like a line of hoary and hairy hobgoblins, staring away from me towards the sun. The dwarfish trees were deformed and twisted by the silent and evil magic of the sea. They seemed to have humpbacks and hidden faces. Everything was at once secretive and vigilant. Even the heap of stones beneath me seemed to be all eyes. But all external oddities were secondary to, or perhaps only symbolic of, the sudden sense of a sacred and splendid ignorance that had fallen upon my soul. The enigma of being alive. Saints have not discovered the answer. Philosophers have not even discovered the riddle. But in that moment, at least, I remembered that I could not remember. But there is one merely human work in which the fundamental mood is truly and wisely recorded. I mean, in the fairy tales. I can never understand why it is that those who happen to disbelieve in Christianity do not go back to the great, healthy, permanent human tradition outside Christianity. Because you cannot rise to the faith, you need not sink to natural philosophy. If I did not put my faith in the gospel, I should not put it in Haeckel. I should put it in Jack the Giant Killer. I should put it in these enduring human stories, with their celebration of hope, surprise, courage, the fulfillment of contracts, and the natural relations of mankind. The point is apart from my present purpose, and I will not pursue it here, but I fancy that it is one of the strange testimonies to Christianity that its opponents do not get clear of it into the original human condition, but go mad with mere reaction and anarchy. Those who object to the faith often object to the human fables. Those who dislike Christianity carry their absurdity to the point of disliking paganism, too. The essence of fairyland is this, that it is a country of which we do not know the laws. This is also a peculiarity of the universe in which we live. We do not know anything about the laws of nature. We do not even know whether they are laws. All that we can do is to take first by faith from our parents, aunts, and nurses, and afterwards by very meager experiment, during the miserably insufficient period of 80 years, the general proposition that there is some sort of strange connection, often repeated but still unexplained, between lighted gunpowder and a loud bang. And it is here that we may see the deep and sound philosophy of the fairy tale. The chemist says, "Mix these three substances, and the bang will follow." The good wizard in the fairy tale says, "Eat these three apples, and the giant's head will fall off." But the chemist talks in a particular tone and style, which suggests that there is an abstract philosophy, some sort of inevitable connection between the three substances and the bang. Sometimes he calls it a necessity, which means a thing that cannot be broken. Sometimes he calls it a law, which means a thing that can be broken. But he always means that the mind sees a connection between the two things, as the mind sees a connection between 4 and 8. And the mind does nothing of the sort. The fairy tale method is far more philosophical. The wizard says, "Do this one extraordinary thing, and that other totally different extraordinary thing does continually follow. I don't know why it does. I don't even know that it will always do it. But it is a tip worth knowing when you want to kill a giant." We do not know that these natural repetitions all around us are laws. We do not know that they are necessities. What we do know about them is that they are magic spells. That is, conditions which exist, but the nature of which is mystical altogether. Water is bewitched, so that it always goes downhill. Birds are bewitched, so that they fly. The sun is bewitched, so that it shines. I rose from the heap of stones, having become altogether a citizen of Fairland. I grasped my stick like a sword, and went up the white road looking for giants. I was disappointed for some little time. The two or three people whom I met being, so far as I could estimate, actually smaller than myself. But there was something of a rapid rigidity in the road running in front of me like a lean white hound that dragged me on in undiminished confidence in the wonders that awaited me, for it is a mark of the essential morality of Fairyland, a thing too commonly overlooked, that happiness in Fairyland, like happiness anywhere else, involves an object and even a challenge. We can only admire scenery if we want to get past it. No man takes his ease in Elfland as in the land of the Lotus Eater. Children are its citizens, and children do not want to take their ease. I hope to find a castle and an ogre. If I had luck, a three-headed ogre, for in Elfland all sport is the defiance of something stronger. Our only hunting is the hunting of big game. I wanted him large and wicked, very wicked. A minute after, the road and hedge turned at an abrupt angle, and I saw before me something that snapped my last faith in reasonable things. There in front of me, solid and silent in the sun, was the unmistakable ogre's castle, turreted and castellated, with an extravagant skyline, exactly as I had seen it brightly colored in my nursery picture books. With all my elvish feelings, I had not really believed that I should find such a fantastic fortress on a road in Kent. Turning to a fat, elderly countryman who was standing by a haystack, himself no doubt a fairy, I said, "Who lives in this place?" "That place?" he said. "Why, that's Mr. Harry Mark's place." And I leaned upon my stick and gazed and thought of the war in Elfland. Reader's note. Harry Marks was an Englishman who engaged in many fraudulent business schemes. At the time of his death in 1916, he owned a 200-acre estate in Kent.
End of A Fairy Tale by G.K. Chesterton.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood.
Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, a registered broker dealer.